Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. I'd like to welcome aboard Mr. Eric Cron. He's a security awareness advocate at a leading cybersecurity firm known as NoB4 out in Clearwater, Florida. Eric, thanks for your time, and thank you for your time this afternoon.
Yeah, happy to be here. Always happy to share some of the knowledge and the stuff that we learn over there with whomever we can.
Exactly. So we've been looking up your background at Google and LinkedIn. Tell us a little bit more about your background and how you got started in cybersecurity and how you ended up where you are right now at NoB4.
Yeah, so I was active duty in the Navy. I did avionics there. It was electronics, very technical sort of field. And from there, I got out and I had a very strong interest in IT anyways. One thing led to another, and I found myself kind of working in IT and then really leaning towards the security side, doing some database stuff, doing some firewall stuff. I worked in medical. I worked in manufacturing industries, worked on through some of that, and ended up working for the U.S. Army and became the security manager at the 2nd Regional Cyber Center Western Hemisphere, which sounds really impressive until you have to answer the phone like that every day. But basically, we were the Army group that did the Active Directory infrastructure and the network infrastructure for all of the Army post camps and stations across North America. So it was a lot of interesting things that I learned in almost a decade in that organization. And then I ended up moving out here to Florida, where I live now from Arizona. And I was the director of member relations and services for ISC Squared, the people that do the CISSP exam, for about 2 years there. And went back in the field for a little bit. And man, next thing I know, I'm here at NoB4 sharing some of my my experience. And it was an interesting way that happened. It was a coworker said, hey, here's a public speaking job. I think you like to do that. And sure enough, like I said, it's been here, 3 years yesterday was my anniversary. So,
oh, congratulations. So are you more of a public speaker at NoB4 or do you do any technical roles where you're at, or can you explain a little bit more?
Yeah, so I mostly do speaking, but it's kind of interesting because with respect to our organization, I'm never out of tech, right? I'm a big geek as it is. I'm sitting here right now in my home office next to my 3D printer, and I have a laser engraver in the garage, and all kinds of stuff like that. That's something that I always love to do. So we also still get to do a lot of technical things working in this role. Like, for example, I've been playing around with deep fake technology, which is where you take videos and replace one person with another within the video. So there's a lot of technical knowledge and learning that we still get to do in that space without all of the stress of, oh, you took down the network over the weekend goofing around,
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for that insight there. Now, let's just go into the cyber threat landscape in general. Why can't we stop the cyber attacker? How is it that they're always like 3 steps ahead of us? It's kind of like a cat and mouse game. And why is it like that? What can we do to kind of stay ahead of them? Or will this always be like it?
Honestly, I think we're always going to be this way. A lot of what we see out there, obviously, technology is growing. There's no doubt about that. It continues to grow, has been growing for, the last couple of decades. And every time the good guys get something that's kind of cool, the bad guys will leverage that for evil too. Or sometimes the bad guys, because they're making a lot of money doing this, end up making some really impressive stuff on the bad side. And then we have to play catch up to do that. So we're always, it's kind of like whack-a-mole, right? And the attacks move around. There's different ways to do this. Every once in a while, we see one of these big attacks that really kind of like hits the front page of the news. Things like when WannaCry hit, right? That was very new. We'd had ransomware around for a while. But when that one hit, that one was new in the fact that it spread so fast. And it used some of these exploits that were created by the U.S., in what it did. And so that really put it on the map. It really got things front and center. But we've been playing this cat and mouse game for years. And if anything, you know, it's morphed. So these days, one of the biggest challenges we have with catching people is there's a lot of push for being anonymous on the internet, right? The Tor browser, which takes you to the dark web places and stuff like that, that was originally spun up to allow whistleblowers to be able to anonymously report things, right? Well, now the bad guys are hosting sites and things out there where it's really hard to find out who they are. And there's ways to do it, but it's not always very easy. And then along comes cryptocurrency, things like Bitcoin, that essentially make it very anonymous for you to do transactions. And that's where ransomware has really taken off through that. And if you look at traditional ransom sorts of things, the parts where the guys end up getting busted, where they get in trouble, where they get arrested, that's usually at the transfer, because there has to be some sort of a physical drop point for the money, for the person or whatever, where these days that doesn't exist. And Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, while they're things that you can trace a little bit, they can be broken down into such little pieces and laundered very, very quickly that really there's no way to track these guys when they do it. Even if we do know who they are also, oftentimes these folks are in countries where we can't extradite. So you get people in Eastern Europe, places where the government isn't going to go pick them up and, you know, and arrest them for us. They're just continuing doing their thing. And even in countries where we might be able to get their law enforcement involved, unfortunately, what happens is they've paid off a lot of that area first because they're making big money, right? So they know far in advance if somebody's putting together something and going to try to come and arrest them. So this is one of those things where I think we're in this for the long haul. I think we're, you know, continuing to do what we can. I've seen a great shift in the industry, though, where we're moving away from always trying to do technical things to a lot of the policy sorts of fixes and tackling the human space, which has been attacked for, you know, years and years and years successfully.
Okay. So can you give me stories? Have you ever dealt with ransomware or cryptojacking or anything like that? Do you have any stories you could tell us, like how you dealt with an attack or how you helped someone kind of overcome, or a business or a organization?
Yeah, you know, I talk to a lot of people that have been hit by ransomware. I've gotten phone calls from people going, hey, you know, I know you did some talks on ransomware. You know, this is what happened. I know one was a manufacturing facility where they called me up and said, look, these folks actually make equipment for the U.S. Army or for the U.S. military, Department of Defense. It's a manufacturing facility. They got hit with ransomware. All of their files, the code that's used on the mills and the machines to do things, as well as their drawings and their parts stuff, all of that had been encrypted. And they were like, what do we do? And, you know, unfortunately, this was one of those strains where there was no decryptor available, which is something that does happen on occasion. Where people go to like ID ransomware and you upload a one of the files, and it can tell you sometimes if there's been a decryptor made for it, but it's like 5% of the time that actually works. So these folks were like, look, our backups got hit by it. Everything got hit by the ransomware, and there's really nothing you can do at that point. They use real encryption. This is not a joke. This is real serious stuff. It's just all of these things come to play. And then, you know, with the backups being hit, you know, I suggested they look for other places they may have saved it, or if they've emailed files to somebody, if they actually have them still in the machines, that they can go recover it. That's kind of a typical thing, is you start looking around these areas that you wouldn't normally think to go try to find files when this happens. But overall, when somebody gets hit by this stuff, they're pretty much done for, and there's not much I'm able to help them with after the fact. I try to get the information out there as much as I can before the fact on ways to protect yourself. But man, once it's hit, it's game over.
Okay. That's too bad. Now, do you recommend your customers or the people that you know who have been hit? Ivan, do you tell them not to pay the cyber attacker in case you're hit by a ransomware attack? Because I've written a lot of blogs about ransomware, and one of the key things is even if you've been hit, do not pay the a cyber attacker, because first, you know, it's hard for the average American citizen to understand really what the Bitcoin is and how to transfer the money. And two, I mean, there's no guarantee that they're going to actually send you the decryption algorithm to get your computer and your files back. So what are your thoughts on that?
No, and that's true. But here's the deal. It ends up coming down to a business decision in the long run. And, you know, when you look at what the FBI says, the FBI says don't pay the ransom. And I get that. But when I talk to special agents out there, in the field, most of them understand. If it's a matter of, hey, I'm not going to pay a $5,000 ransom, I'm going to shut down the business that I've, you know, been working for 15 years to bring up, they understand that's a business decision. Now, the cons to paying the ransom is you're putting more money in their pocket to perpetuate the attacks in the future, right? So you don't want that to happen. You never know, like you said, if you're going to get your files back. Now, I will say that this is an odd criminal industry in that they place a lot of weight on customer service in many cases. And that's because they know that if people go around and they say, well, you'll never get your files back even if you do pay, then people are not going to pay. So we've even seen strains of ransomware, like Sporo was one of them. It was very well done. Like the user interface was beautiful. They had a chat box over there where you could live chat with people that could help you purchase Bitcoin, that could extend the time before all of your files are gone. There's ways that, you know, in some cases they'll be able to negotiate down. I was working with a group of municipalities, and one of the guys I was talking to, they got hit, and they were kind of a small town, and they said the ransom was something like $50,000. And they just told them, they said, look, here's the deal. We can probably scrounge up about $5,000, but we don't have $50,000 here. This is the best we can do, or we're just going to go, you know, bite the bullet and start over again. And the attackers turned around and said, yeah. Okay. So they got to negotiate down on that side a little bit. But ultimately what it boils down to is, try not to pay the ransom if there is any way around that, because again, it perpetuates future attacks. Number two is really, if you do end up paying the ransom, fix whatever it is that allowed you to be in that particular spot to begin with, right? There was a medical place not too long ago, and I'm trying not to, you know, call anyone out because frankly, this is a really hard thing to defend against, so I don't want to drag them through the mud. But they got hit through a vendor that came in through a remote access portal and basically, you know, hit them out. Now, what they decided was they said, we have good backups. The problem is we can't restore fast enough to get back online. Well, so what they did is they paid the ransom and were able to get back up because they underestimated essentially how quickly they could get all of their stuff back up. And I find that happens a lot of times where either they think they have a good backup, but the backup is accessible from the network and ends up getting encrypted itself. Or they figure out that, wait a minute, you know, when I restore one machine, it may take me 27 minutes, but when I'm restoring 100 of them, it doesn't scale linearly. And so they find themselves in a position where, you know, they got a lot of problems. And I believe the numbers that I've seen on ransomware, it was Sophos and Kaspersky had these numbers. I believe it was $133,000 was the average cost of ransomware. And the downtime, it was over a week on average that they had to go without their files. The other interesting thing about that was, and this was from Sophos, the In about 75% of the cases, the people had up-to-date endpoint protection when the ransomware struck. So they had antivirus on their machines. It was up-to-date, and the ransomware just, you know, took off anyways. So it's a real challenge for these folks. But ultimately, when it boils down to it, it's got to be a business decision. I just say try to plug the hole where they got in last time so they don't turn around and get it again. And you're always rolling the dice when you pay criminals to get your data back, right? Is it damaged? Is it not damaged? Et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Now, do you think that one of the best ways to protect against ransomware is to just simply back up your files in case you're hit? And if your business is small enough, like me, I mean, I'm kind of like a one-man, two-man shop. I mean, I can just get a new laptop and restore my files from Dropbox. But now, what about a bigger, much like a Fortune 100 company? What kind of strategies do you recommend for them with that? Simply bagging up files, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's really, I tend to talk about, you know, a handful of different things you can do. The number one thing that you can do and that's been shown to work is train your users not to fall for the phishing attacks, because this is where most of the stuff mm-hmm. comes in. So whether it's a straight up phishing email that has malware on it, or whether it's, getting information to get into the system or suckering them to enter their credentials so that they can then turn around and use them to log in, all of those things are attacks on the humans. And those tend to be the way that these things are happening, right? So that's the number one way, is train your people to spot these things. That helps with a lot of other issues besides ransomware too. The number two thing is have what I like to call weapons grade backups. And what that means is you got to take it seriously. You mentioned Dropbox, and Dropbox is all good, but you have to also understand that there have been strains of ransomware that will look on the machine and try to see if they have the Dropbox software installed or like Google Drive, and they will try to encrypt those files first because they know that that's going to be somebody's fallback, right? So you want to have good backups on the larger organizations. Make sure that you test them on occasion. And I like to tell people at least once a month, try to restore some of the key files that you have, right? Like it doesn't have to be all of them, but make sure you can randomly grab some of your key things and restore those files. Know how long it takes. And then every 6 months, I like to tell people, do a full restore of all of your critical servers and stuff, whether it's on an external drive or whatever. Just make sure you can actually get that data back. And especially when you're working in cloud situations, that you can get it back quickly. Now, I used to back up like all my photos and stuff to a certain cloud provider. And what I found was in my testing, I could upload pretty quickly. And I had quite a bit up there. I had about a terabyte of data up there. But when it came to restore it, the way that the software worked, it would zip up some files, but it would fail on any of the large files or any of the groups. And I was having to grab them a couple at a time to get them down. It would have taken me, months to restore my data from there. And had I not tested that, I wouldn't have known that, right? So make sure that you understand that. Make sure you exercise them. Make sure that your backups are not something that can be hit from the network. Like some people will back up workstations to a network share, or they'll share that backup drive for whatever reason. And the ransomware goes after that and encrypts your backups, and then you're stuck. Another thing you can do that really, really helps is try to segment your network. And what that means is try to put your machines in groups where only certain things can talk to other things, right? So, for example, I like to use this. If your receptionist in your office can reach some of your database servers, your SQL servers in production, you have a problem there. They should not be able to contact those machines from their machine, right? So what that does is if somebody does get infected, it limits how far it can go. So it may only hit a few workstations or a couple of servers or whatever instead of everything. And well, this is what we saw at NHS when WannaCry hit, is they had what's called a flat network. In other words, pretty much everything could communicate with each other. And so this worm got in there and just kept spreading between all of these things that could talk. So you want to try to limit that as much as you can. And this helps not just with ransomware, but if a hacker gets in, gets remote access to a machine, they can only get to certain things, right? So it's helpful in multiple ways there. Another one is to limit the permissions that people have on files. Again, I'm going to use the receptionist here. If the receptionist can write to a file, then they can also encrypt that file. So if you have a shared drive, like some people have a G drive or an S drive that has accounting and marketing and all those things in it in the smaller companies, if one person can write to all of those folders, if they're infected, they can encrypt them all. If they have read-only access, though, they can't. And so that can really limit how much damage can be done if that person is infected. So that's a huge piece of it right there also. And then, you know, you always got to have your endpoint protection, whether it's 75% effective or not. It is better than not having something on there. We found, you know, again, every once in a while, you'll find that the endpoint protection, the antivirus grabs it and says, hold on a second, are you sure you wanted to do this? And that's fantastic, but it's not something you can rely on. So what you see here is it's kind of a layered approach. There are multiple things you have to do to really kind of protect yourself from this. The good news is most of it's not horribly expensive. It does take a little bit of time and effort to put in place, but it also protects you against other kinds of attacks, not just ransomware.
Yeah, true. Thanks for those tips. Yeah, a lot of good insight there. Now, is there a common element to these types of attacks like cryptojacking, ransomware, phishing? Is there a common thread or a common theme that we just can't really detect yet, or what are your thoughts on that?
I really don't see, you know, other than industries being targeted by certain groups, I don't really see a common theme, if you will. What's really happened is the bad guys know that these folks have money, or they, you know, everyone has a wallet. And what's interesting about ransomware is, as opposed to like a traditional stealing data attack, is if you're in an attack and you steal a bunch of data, well, now you have to take that data and you have to sell it somewhere, right? And you have to find buyers, and they may not be interested in the data and all that kind of stuff, right? With ransomware, any organization, large, small, in between, whatever, they need their data to continue to work. And so their data has value to them, regardless of whether their data has value to anyone else. Plus, they don't have to necessarily exfiltrate the data. In other words, they don't have to download it, which can pop some red flags and people can see that traffic. They don't have to do any of that kind of stuff. It just kind of happens, you know, it happens all there within the organization. So every organization is willing to pay for their own data back where they may not, you know, be able to sell it otherwise. And so this is what's really sparked this. This is what's really opening some of the smaller organizations' eyes too, is everyone thinks, well, I'm too small to be attacked. Nobody's going to care. Well, they do, because you're willing to pay for it. And so the way that these things just keep going, it's any industry, it's every industry. Although with ransomware specifically, we see it a lot in industries that really can't do without their data for long amounts of time. So medical, right? You hear a lot about medical places being attacked because they're willing to pay because they're really hurt by it. So if somebody loses their patient records, they can't gain access to the patient record. I can't think of a surgeon in the world that's going to roll a patient in to do surgery when they can't look at their record and look for allergies and, you know, previous conditions and all of that kind of stuff, right? If they can't see their patient records, they are not going to do surgery on them. You can't hardly treat somebody because you don't know their allergies. You don't know their, you know, medication history, all those sorts of things. So it really, really hurts that industry. With manufacturing, they found that, you know, in order to make widgets, you have to have your files that that go on these machines that help make those widgets. And so if you stop a production line, that costs a tremendous amount of money. They tend to run these things just constantly. They're just running. And anytime you can make a delay in that, there's value to getting that back. So those folks are definitely willing to pay. And of course, cities and municipalities, same sort of thing, right? We see this over and over again where the 911 call center is taken down, which is, to me, a terrifying thing to think that I'm going to call into my 911 call and have them going, okay, hold on, my pen stopped working. I need to get another one and write it down, right? Nobody wants to be in that spot. So there's emergency services that get affected, but also municipalities do so many other things that you don't think about, right? Filing real estate transactions. So, you know, making sure that that's taken care of. You can't buy or sell property a lot of times if the deed office is down. We see it with paying your electric, paying your water, all of those things get taken into account. Marriage licenses a lot of times can't be issued when this happens. I mean, it's just one thing after another, after another, after another. It's pretty brutal how this happens. So when you get in these industries where they can't afford any downtime, or where the downtime is very, very disruptive to them or to other folks, that's a big deal. As opposed to, let's say, mom and pop's bakery that gets taken down, and you know, what do they lose? They lose some customer records, maybe. Well, they can still make muffins. They can still make all of these cupcakes. They can still sell stuff without having their system up. And that's really where I see the trends going, is for these people that need their data. They need it now. Cryptojacking is, you know, the other side of that. You've mentioned a couple times here. And cryptojacking, the interesting thing is, I've seen a lot of cryptojacking also happened during ransomware attacks. So essentially, what happens is they download the ransomware, but when the ransomware is downloaded, they use typically what's called a dropper. So the thing that you click on in the email isn't actually the ransomware. It's going to be a dropper. And what it does is it fires off, and then it goes out to the internet and downloads whatever they tell it to do. And this could be banking trojans. This could be cryptojacking software. This could be the ransomware, et cetera, et cetera. But it may grab more than one. And so we've seen that happening, where they'll do the ransomware piece, and while that's all going on, they're also running crypto mining software out there, which is using your resources to make them money in cryptocurrency. So we've seen some pretty interesting trends with that. Now, the larger the organization, the larger the pool they are likely to be able to hit, where they'll be able to use these machines to generate cryptocurrency for them. So, of course, they're going to like the larger organizations when it comes to that sort of thing.
Well, okay. Now, what is it that the cyber attacker is exactly after? I mean, are they wanting the usernames and passwords? Is it money, or do they just want the public recognition that, hey, I've hacked the U.S. Army Cyber Attack Center, I've hacked the Bank of America website? Is this the prestige factor, or what? Or is it all three of them, really?
You know, anymore, what we're seeing in the ransomware especially is, this is not, I like to say, the kids drinking Mountain Dew and eating pizza in their mom's basement. These are a lot more organized attacks. So we have nation states involved. We have terrorist groups that use this to fund their, you know, their kinetic attacks, you know, the bombs and guns and stuff on the other side. We see organized crime in this. Mostly, this is about the money. And whether it's in cybercrime in general, whether it's grabbing data that can be used or sold or something like that, or whether it's going straight for the money, like wire transfer fraud, things like that, it generally all boils down to the money. And, you know, like I said, it can be data. So, for example, a good example of that is, every year in the first quarter, we tend to see a lot of tax scams. And one of those is W-2 fraud. So what this boils down to is, somebody in an organization that's trying to pretend to be someone in leadership ends up sending an email to, let's say, the payroll department or whomever and say, I need you to send me all of the W-2s for the employees. I need them for whatever. And there's usually a story behind it. I need these right away, so on and so forth. And so these organizations end up sending all of the employee W-2s to the attackers, thinking they're sending it to someone in leadership. Well, the attackers then take that tax information and file the tax returns on behalf of all of the employees. And of course, everybody ends up getting a refund that year, right? Yay. The problem is when the employee actually goes to then file their taxes, they find out it's already been done for them. The money is long gone, and then they end up having to play games with the IRS for about a year, at least a year, to get their money back. And everyone I've talked to when I'm out on the road and I'm talking to groups who's been affected by this, it's been at least a year of having to deal with the IRS trying to get the income tax returns that they are owed back to them. Sometimes it's even more. Most of the time they have to have alternative IDs or PIN numbers in order to file their taxes moving forward because that data has been compromised. So it tends to be a real pain on the people too. And this is just the information being stolen. And not only that, once they file those taxes, a lot of times they'll turn around and sell that information on the dark web because this is your income, your social security number, your address, all of that kind of stuff that you need to put together other stuff. So ultimately, though, even though they're not going after cash directly, they're going after information that they can turn into cash pretty quickly and pretty easily. So, again, it's not really the hackers trying to make a name for themselves very much. This tends to be much, much larger and more organized than that these days.
Well, yeah, I had a good friend of mine. He was my major professor when I was doing my MBA. In fact, I think his tax return was fraudulently filed. It took him almost 2 years to finally get his tax return straightened out and get his money back. It's just awful, and especially with the IRS being as understaffed as they are right now. I can only imagine what a nightmare it could be.
Yeah, and I mean, who wants to deal with the IRS anyways, right?
Well, I've had to actually because they made a mistake in filing. Well, not to get into too much detail, but they made a mistake in some of my Obamacare filing. It took almost a year and a half to get that straightened out. It took them almost a year's technology. I sent them a letter trying to address the issue. So anyway, I just can't imagine what it'd be like trying to figure out your tax return with them. That'd even be more of a nightmare. But hopefully, I pray that it doesn't happen to anybody. That's just truly, a horrible situation to be in. Now, you brought up one different thing here, and what I want to kind of get in more detail is the critical infrastructure. I'm seeing in the news headlines more and more that more critical infrastructure is being attacked in the U.S., like the one in Baltimore, I think, is the most recent one that comes across my mind. I don't think they paid the ransomware attack, if I'm correct, but what are your thoughts on the attacks on critical infrastructure? If a cyber attacker wanted to, they don't have to take planes anymore and crash into buildings. I mean, they could literally shut down a city within minutes and just paralyze it, with no water, no gas, no electricity. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, fortunately, like with Baltimore and Atlanta and all that, these were attacks more on the systems for billing and things like that. So the critical services remained available. However, there is a big focus right now on our critical infrastructure. And unfortunately, a lot of this stuff is very old. It's been around for a long, long time. It's legacy equipment. And throughout the years they've managed to tack on this or that to connect it for remote monitoring and things like that across the internet, which tends to be insecure. But I personally have concerns about our infrastructure and the way that these sorts of things can impact us. I mean, again, you're taking a cyber attack and turning it into a physical attack in some ways. You could, overspin turbines in a hydroelectric dam, all the things. Imagine what could go wrong in a nuclear power plant, right? But there are a lot of other things that they can also be doing with power grids and all of that stuff. And yeah, it's very scary. The one thing that I think lets me sleep at night is the fact that we're aware of that. And I know there are a lot of people out there that are working extremely hard to try to secure these areas, to try to fix this problem that we have there. So in that sense, we're not blind to this problem. And there's, a lot of effort trying to fix it. Unfortunately, there isn't a whole lot of money that is generally available for these fixes either. And the equipment is just aging. I mean, this stuff has been in place and it works well, but it's been in place for many, many years, and it's very vulnerable to all of these different kinds of things now. So I'm hoping that we'll see some improvements in that, but I really think that, you know, we are at risk. But I also think on the flip side of that, I would venture to say that we probably have ways to counterattack other nations if it was to come down to that. When it comes to warfare and things, you know, we've seen some of that go on already here and there. But it is something that is definitely concerning to me. But you know, hopefully we'll get our arms around that one pretty soon.
And the other thing you brought up were the nation-state threat actors. You know, we keep hearing stories about, like, North Korea, China, and Russia. Not to get political here, but what are your thoughts on that as well, too? I mean, are we going to still see an increase on cyber attacks from these threat actors, or will Iran now make its way into the cyber threat landscape, or what do you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, modern warfare is done far less with guns and troops as it is with cyber attacks and information gathering. And, you know, it used to be that spies had to be on the ground to gather information. That's not happening anymore. There's a lot that's happening in that area. And if you look at countries like Israel, they are very aware of these threats, and they've put a lot of emphasis as a nation into defending against cyber attacks and having those cyber attack capabilities. You know, this has been from the very top, this has been a drive for them. And it's ironic, if you look at the information security landscape and a lot of the organizations that are being started in security, a lot of them are Israeli companies. They're out of that area because they put such an emphasis on it. And Israel knows they're physically a small country. And so, you know, they've got to defend themselves, and they know that the warfare is going to be coming more and more electronic. So it only makes sense to do that. And I think they've actually done a pretty good job with that. But I think all of the countries are having to, or have accepted that. You know, North Korea, there are some incredibly intelligent people up there that are doing attacks all the time. There are, you know, China is, it always blows my mind with China, because they're our friends in that we have a lot of trade with them, right? If you go to Walmart, 2/3 of the store is stocked with made in China stuff. We spend a lot of money to and from with goods there, but we're constantly attacking each other. And that's, you know, that's well known that that's going on. Iran definitely has some intelligent people in there. This cyber landscape is really, really starting to change how modern warfare works as well. And it's fascinating to me, but also a little bit scary as well, because nowadays, you know, we can launch an attack from, you know, 30,000 miles away, or, you know, 10,000 miles away, or down the street at a coffee shop. There's no telling where this kind of stuff is going to be coming from. But we have that flexibility to do it from just anywhere. You don't see troop movements on satellite as much anymore, because that's not how they're moving. They're moving across the wires, if you will.
Right. Okay. Now, how do you foresee the cyber threat landscape changing in the coming years? Like, you know, we're halfway through 2019. What do you think is going to happen this year or in going into 2020?
So I see a lot more automation on both sides, both on the offensive and defensive sides. We're already seeing that. We're seeing AI being deployed in, you know, for real and in marketing on both sides right now. But we're seeing that happen because also the amount of data and digital footprint that we leave these days as individuals, as organizations, is growing exponentially, right? And people are learning how to take that digital footprint, that information that you have that's out there, and spawn that into very targeted attacks against individuals, right? So if I know your hobbies, if I know where you bank, if I know those sorts of things, I can now make very crafted sorts of attacks against you using that information. And so as we continue to see breaches that spill that kind of information, as we continue to see those sorts of things happen, and we continue to see the increases in the automation and the AI stuff, I think what we're going to do is we're going to be seeing a lot better crafted attacks. Like if you think about it from the email side and phishing, we've all seen or heard of the Nigerian print scam, right? We're all familiar with that, but we don't see that type of attack anymore. These are not that simplistic with the bad grammar, with the bad spelling, right? And if you take things like smishing attacks over SMS phishing, basically, you know, you get a text message from Wells Fargo and it says, hey, you know, you need to go confirm your account, and you go, haha, nice try. I don't bank with Wells Fargo, right? It's an easy way to spot that. But what about if that comes in and it's like, you know, Second National Bank of Lincoln, Nebraska, where you happen to bank because that information has been leaked to somebody? It's much harder to tell, and people let the guard down because they think, oh, because it's somewhat obscure, you know, I don't have to worry about being attacked by that. But that's not the case. Again, we're going to see this expand, and we're going to see the automation pieces, both on the offense and the defense, really stepping up the game to include AI, which can be very powerful. I would say right now it is very much a buzzword in the industry, which is not always, you know, it's not always really what's going on is true AI. But, you know, it's definitely something that people are starting to look towards leveraging, and people are starting to learn more and more about. The other side of that, and I mentioned it a little bit earlier, is like the deep fake attacks where they're replacing faces in videos. And that's pretty cool right now. It's funny to watch. You know, recently we just had all this stuff with the app on Instagram or whatever with the face swap, right? Making you look old. And if you look at that, I'm very fascinated by this because, first of all, the technology is very good. When you look at those, it is extremely, extremely well done. It's very convincing. It does not look like something very poor. So that technology is coming a long ways. And then the flip side to that is everyone is freaking out because of the Russians, because it was done by a Russian developer. Although I don't believe this is Russia trying to gather all of our information, right? I don't see a whole lot of value to them as a country like that. But it is interesting that it's brought up some more of the EULA sorts of things, like the license agreements and what we allow other people to do with the data when we're doing these sorts of things. That seems to come up on occasion. And this is another one of those places where that really brought that up, because you're signing away a lot of rights to things. And to me, that's a very important piece there. But I think watching that technology, which imagine if you could take that technology and leverage it into fooling somebody into thinking that they're talking to, you know, someone they know, let's say live in, you know, FaceTime or something like that. When that sort of technology starts happening, think about how you could play games with that and try to trick people into doing stuff or you know, give up stuff that way too. That could be pretty ugly when we start getting down that road.
Yeah, AI is actually, you know, the big buzzword. In fact, I put together a book proposal. I'm hoping to write a book on the use of AI, you know, machine learning, computer vision, and neural networks, you know, as to how they can help, you know, automate, you know, the security technologies that we have right now, and to, you know, help predict what the future cybersecurity threat landscape is going to be. Have you done any work yourself on artificial intelligence or ML or neural networks or anything like that?
You know, mine's been very limited to some of the things I've been working with, some of the deepfake sort of things, where, you know, I'm doing it for fun right now and just to kind of learn how this is working and see where this is going and how good I can make it happen. So I'm a little bit limited on my exposure to that other than doing different, you know, different types of learning techniques and tweaking things on these videos that I've been playing around with in direct support to that. I think it's fascinating. I got into learning about TensorFlow, which is a pretty good, you know, backend that a lot of folks are using. And quite frankly, my eyes glazed over about, you know, about 30 seconds into the introduction to TensorFlow article. I mean, this is some pretty deep stuff that's going on here. So I'm still fascinated. I still want to look into it, but I think I have a lot more stuff to do before I get that going too much.
What is TensorFlow? Can you explain it to our audience, please?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What is TensorFlow exactly? Can you explain a little bit more in detail?
So yeah, TensorFlow, as far as I can tell, sorry, I was coughing there for a second. As far as I can tell, again, I'm just kind of getting into it. That's kind of an AI backend, and I believe it was designed by Google. And so it's designed by Google. It's what Google uses to do a lot of their stuff. And it's something that's freely available. It's kind of neat how it works. I don't even want to try to explain it because I'm not sure I have it all down, like I said, yet. But if you're interested in learning a little bit about that, that seems to be a very popular one that's out there. So it's TensorFlow is the name of it.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay, now, what do you think the biggest cyber threat is going to be? Now, we've talked about the landscape. What do you think that threat's going to be out there? I always ask this of my podcast guests. I get asked this question. The common denominator seems always going to be phishing or some sort of phishing variant. What are your thoughts on that?
I absolutely agree. And it's why I work with KnowBe4. I mean, I really feel like I can try to help people understand how big the phishing problem is, but I think the human element is by far and away the biggest threat we have out there, whether it's straight phishing, whether it's, you know, any of these other attacks through SMS, through voice phishing, through hybrid attacks, where they'll send an email and follow up with a text message, all of that stuff, targeting the human side of things there is far and away the biggest threat. It's really how the bad guys get into networks, whether they're just trying to get in there and cruise around or whether they're actually trying to make the money right then and there. It's the people, the people, the people. And unfortunately, historically in the industry, we've ignored that side of things, largely because I think it's uncomfortable for a lot of people. We don't really like to do training, right? If you think about it this way, I don't know of many information security or IT people that have ever said, I totally want to go apply for this job because it says I get to train end users, right? That's just not the world we live in. It tends to be not what we enjoy. And so it's been kind of neglected or done. And this is not a critique of individuals, but I think it's been done poorly in the past because that's not where our strong suit is. So you task us with something like training end users. Here we are, a bunch of technical people that would much rather be at a keyboard. And then we're supposed to train users in accounting and marketing and, you know, all of these other places to understand what's going on and how they're being attacked. And I think we've just unfortunately not been able to do a great job of that. Now, on the flip side, it's been getting taken a lot more seriously lately. So, you know, just where I'm at KnowBe4, which that's what we do, is we do security awareness training and a simulated phishing platform. But I've seen a huge uptake in people when I go to conferences from, oh, what is it you guys do? You know, 3 years ago, what is it you guys do? Oh, really? How's that work? To, oh, we're a customer. Or, yeah, we've heard about you. Or, yeah, we just implemented a program. And I think that's great because now we've brought in third parties from the outside that really know how to do the training well, and they've made it to where it's easy for organizations to use, and it frees up your technical people to do the technical things that we excel at instead of trying to do the training. So I think that threat is definitely going to be there on the human side, but I'm really excited about what we're seeing these days in people addressing that threat, I think, much better than we have historically.
Okay. Now, another thing that's coming up in cybersecurity is the Internet of Things, or IoT, where, you know, everything's basically connected to one another, you know, like smart cities, smart homes. I find this personally to be very scary because I just think it only increases the attack surface for the cyber attacker, meaning there are many, many points that they, he or she can get into, and a lot of these vendors who are making IoT products are not really making them secure enough. In fact, I think the only legislation that's been passed on IoT was one in California. I think it was passed in January of this year. And it was deemed to be a general, you know, mandate, but there's really nothing in the way guards of securing actual devices and products. What are your thoughts on IoT? And is it going to be a good thing, bad thing, or what are your feelings on it?
Yeah, IoT, now I'm going to preface this with the fact that I am an absolute geek, like I said before, and I'm fascinated by all of these cool things, right? Like Alexa, and I'm sitting here right now with the smart Wi-Fi plug, you know, on my desk waiting to install. I've made my own smart sensors. I do some of that stuff on my own. But what we're doing right now is, We're plugging these things in, and we're doing all of these smart features, but unfortunately, yeah, the security is lax. And we honestly, in some ways, this may not be a popular opinion, but we have consumers to blame for that in some cases, and that's because if you look at a manufacturer needs to make things and they need to sell things, right? And if the consumers will buy something that's a dollar cheaper but hasn't done any security work, but, you know, it's just less expensive, if they're going to do that, where is the, you know, where's the motivation for manufacturers to spend the extra money to do things from the initial security to having patch cycles to doing that sort of stuff, right? So if the consumer doesn't demand it and they're not willing to pay for it, can we fault a manufacturer for building something for as inexpensively as they can when the customer says, I don't care about that, right? They only care about it when it all goes wrong. And so we have this issue there. Now, with smart devices, we're seeing, you know, things with Alexa and the Google devices and recording our voices and things like that. We're seeing more and more of that out there, which is raising consumer awareness. But far and away, I think what I see more often is things like, what was it? The Yi cameras, Yi cameras. These are something that they were selling on Amazon. It's got fantastic pictures of like $21 or something. I keep hearing people go, oh, wow, these are great cameras. These are great cameras. Well, what they turned around and did is after the folks got a lot of these things installed, they changed their terms and conditions and said that they can access the video at any time they want to, view the video from your cameras over in China. And if you don't agree to that, you can't run the software anymore. So basically you end up with a brick on your deal, but people are still willing to pay $20 for this really nice camera and give up that sort of, you know, privacy, if you will, or they don't pay any attention to it. They don't care, as opposed to maybe spending $40 on something that doesn't have that sort of cloud storage or the, you know, that sort of, thing going on there. And I find that that to me is a frustrating piece. Even when you tell people, hey, you know, this gives you them the rights to do all this stuff, they're like, well, yeah, but it's inexpensive and I'm willing to risk it, right? So that to me is probably one of the more frustrating things that I'm seeing with these smart devices going on out there. That and the fact that when people implement them, they don't know what they're doing. They're plugging these things into their network and they're not thinking about it. And a lot of this stuff that's designed for home use is going into small business as well, right? Nest thermostats, things like that. That's a whole different ball game than just in your home as well. And you're right, it does. It creates another attack surface. We've seen Android TVs being used for crypto mining, as a matter of fact, you know, through some of the ADB miner stuff. We see all of these devices that are getting plugged in organizations on the side. You know, people come in and they plug in their stuff. And the larger organizations are oftentimes able to deal with that better than the smaller organizations. But, you know, it's only a matter of time till everyone wants their Alexa on their desk at work, too, because they're used to that. And we've got to think about how that's going to end up playing into things in the long run, too. But again, we end up in a situation where we're trading convenience for cost and or security. And basically in that triad, you can have, you know, two or three, but not all of them.
Gotcha. Now, another issue that's coming up here is C-suite holding them more accountable to cyber attacks, cyber threats, and securing their lines of defense for their respective, you know, entity where they work at. Now, you know, it's always easy to say, okay, there's a cyber threat, let's blame the CISO or the CIO, let's fire them. But don't you think the employees should be blamed also? I mean, everybody's responsible for protecting their own company where they work for. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of mixed on where the CIO or CISO should be. You know, they should almost lose their job immediately because of that. I mean, what good is that going to do? Is that going to solve any problems? I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of mixed on it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, you know, firing the CISO or the CIO does solve some problems for organizations, especially larger publicly traded ones, right? It shows that, oh, we're serious about it. We fired the person that was responsible, okay? That's a PR stunt or move. It's sort of expected in many cases if you're in that role that you would be the sacrificial lamb if it goes wrong. I, like you, I'm really torn on the idea of how do you handle the users, right? Like, do they have some responsibility in that? Where do you draw the line on that too? Like, we've all had users and users that were those sort of people that were like, I don't care. I just don't care. I don't care. That's your problem, not mine, right? And those people, I say, yeah, we need to hold them responsible if they're not doing the things we teach them to do. But what about the people that we aren't teaching correctly, right? Or that they just aren't getting it. Are we actually helping them understand, or are we just throwing some training at them once a year and saying, hey, here you go. Now you're expected to be safe, right? So at what point in time do you start having that responsibility? And that's a challenge for me. I personally believe at some point in time, if the person continues to exhibit the same bad behavior or risky behavior, you may need to find a new place for them, whether it's a different role in the organization that doesn't have email or whatever it is, or maybe another organization. I think we do need to take it seriously because it can cripple our company. But we owe it to the end users to give them every chance to try to learn. We can't just throw something out there and go, you know, it's all taken care of. Now, I've seen this debate a couple of times in the industry, and people tend to get, you know, pretty hot under the collar about it. But I've always worked under the premise that you give people kudos loudly and publicly, but when they do something wrong, you deal with that privately and quietly, right? So if you have somebody that keeps messing up, you drag their boss into it, you drag HR into it, you keep trying to train them, you keep trying to help them. But again, if they continue to exhibit risky behaviors, you're going to have to draw the line somewhere. And I think about it this way. If you have users that are going out, downloading stuff all the time off of different websites and installing it on their machines, you're going to eventually let that person go because of the risk they are to the organization. And I think this we have to kind of handle the same way. But it is very, very it's very hard because I can't come up with anything that's a real good, like quantifiable, you've done this two times in this amount of time to write into a policy that you then start, you know, eliminating people over. So that is a tough one. That really, really is. And I don't think we have that figured out yet. But, you know, I err on the fact that eventually this person could take your business out. So you have to treat it seriously.
Right. Now, you know, cyber attacks can come from the technical standpoint, attacking servers, and we're now seeing probably an uptick in social engineering where they're now playing upon human emotions. So do you think money and finances should be spent either in the tech or the non-tech defenses or both? What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think that the emotional attacks have been going on for years. I think they're getting more emotional, and that may be a societal thing, but the emotional attacks have been going on for years. If you think about it, the Nigerian prince scam I mentioned before, that was an emotional attack, but the greed it attacked there was, or the emotion it attacked was greed, right? It's, you give me a little bit of money and I'm going to give you a lot of money. That was that kind of attack. But what they've started to do is they've really started to leverage fear and helpfulness in a lot of these attacks. So things like the CEO fraud attacks, where it's a wire transfer fraud. What we see happen a lot of times with those is they'll start out very simple. It'll be something from like the CEO to let's say someone in, you know, like a financial controller. And we've seen them where they started out with something simple that just said, hey, did you get my earlier email? Again, from the CEO to financial controller. And the controller looks through, they look at their email, and they end up replying saying, sir, ma'am, I'm sorry, I don't see an email from you previously. How can I help you? And then what happens is they'll flip that and they'll turn it into something where it's like, well, I emailed you earlier. I told you we needed to wire this money immediately. There's always a story behind it. You know, where I'm acquiring this company. It popped up. We need to do this now before someone else jumps on it. I can't believe you messed this up. Now I got to go in and fix what you messed up. While I'm in there fixing your screw up, I need you to wire this money ASAP so I can tell them it's there or we're going to lose this deal. And so they will crank up the you know, the fear factor there and the scare tactics to get these people to do that. We're seeing much improved ways that they do this, right? Like the way that they pull this off is amazing. And this even goes into some of the things, you know, we got gift card scams out there we're seeing go on all the time. People are, I just can't believe how much they're dumping gift cards out there for things. And we look at some of these attacks too, like, for example, one of the IRS ones, you know, IRS calls you and says, hey, you need to pay this amount in iTunes gift cards by the end of my shift, or we're going to come arrest you. And we look at it from the outside and we go, that's just stupid. Nobody's ever going to believe that, right? I'll tell you one thing, they're doing it because it does work. And we have to understand that sometimes when you're in the middle of the emotions, it's not as easy to tell your way through. And somebody pointed this out to me on those IRS ones. Imagine you're somebody who is not necessarily from this country, that's immigrated to this country. Your old government tended to be a little bit heavy-handed and was, you know, everyone is afraid of. And now you get this call from the U.S. IRS and it says, you're going to do this or we're throwing you in jail. It's going to be terrifying. And so they lose that that critical thinking step to go, oh, the IRS isn't going to care about iTunes gift cards or Amazon gift cards. They don't care. They're just like, whatever I can do not to go to jail. But if you put yourself in that situation and think about all of the different people that are targeted by these, I can absolutely see how that can be effective with those people. But we see these scams. We see helpfulness scams. We see, you know, all of these things that are going on, and they happen, you know, every time there's a natural disaster, you got people wanting to donate money to fake charities. We see them using those as ways to get into people's emails, like, hey, click here to go donate, or, you know, share this, share that, that sort of stuff. But we also see, you know, a lot of these sorts of attacks also happening on the political spectrum. You know, and to your point earlier, let's not get political here, but you may have noticed in the last couple of years, there's a little bit of political tension going on in this country of ours. And as an attacker, if I can get you riled up by saying, oh, so-and-so did this, I can't believe it, this looks like it's going to be something, click this link, go here, fill out this petition, we need to stop this right away. And the petition is, you know, your name, your address, your social security number, the name of your first pet, mother's maiden name, because, well, they need to verify that you're real for this official petition. People fall for that because they're in a heightened emotional state, which takes away our critical thinking pieces. So it's not new, but I think they've really, really honed their tradecraft on this, and they're getting much, much better at getting people to fall for these things.
Okay. Finally, as we wrap up our show, the one, I guess, $60,000 question I'm going to ask you is, and I keep getting asked this, what are your top five, you know, laundry list of things you tell people to protect themselves and even a business entity from a cyber attack?
Yeah, on the business side, again, it's make sure that you train your end users. Put some effort into that because the attacks are happening on the users. Use a service like ours or like one of our competitors. That's fine too. Or do it internally, but do it well. In other words, for technical people, you know, involve your marketing department, involve your HR department, the people that are trained to work with human behavior. Get them involved, but put some good effort into it. In other words, take that part seriously. That's a key thing. Double check those backups. Make sure your backups are in place. Make sure they're working well. That is absolutely, absolutely critical when it comes to this. Make sure you have decent endpoint protection in place. The other thing that I really like to tell people is if you're in a situation where you've received an unsolicited phone call, a text message, or an email, and it elicits an emotional response. Like it gets you upset, it gets you riled up. It doesn't always mean it's an attack, but take a minute to step back and think about it critically. Go, okay, wait a minute, does this all really make sense, right? And that will help folks get into a mindset that's it's a little bit, it makes them less gullible by doing that because, again, they try to spike those emotions to get you to do silly things. So I do like to tell people, yeah, if you have an emotional response to something, take that deep breath and really try to focus on some of the critical thinking around it. Those are some of the key things I like to tell organizations and have them share with their people as well.
Okay. Well, Eric, we thank you for your time this afternoon. I think it was a wonderful podcast. We hope to have you again on some future ones as well.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. Take care.